I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. This is my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci. Well, we're very grateful for the time you've given us. The first question that I have for you is about the Texas border and the Haitian immigrants. What do you think about immigration in the time of COVID? What do you think about 12,000 people trying to come into this country? It's assumed that they're unvaccinated, correct?
You know, my making any comment about that, you know, everything I say gets ripped off by far-right people and get me into the usual nonsense. I am somebody who does favor immigration.
Right.
My family, my grandfather and grandmothers on both sides were immigrants. So, I mean, I think that what we need to do is do whatever we can to treat them fairly, to get them the right medical care, and to get them vaccinated if possible.
Is that a goal, to get them vaccinated?
I would hope so.
Right.
I mean,
that's not your purview. But
no, that's not my purview at all, but I would think that that would be important.
Right. You see a lot recently on CNN.com about antivirals. Here's the pill. They said that maybe we can get back to normal. What do you think the hope is for antivirals in the coming months?
Well, I think not only is it a hope, Alec, I think it really is a necessity, because the primary countermeasure for a respiratory-borne viral illness is always vaccine to prevent it, particularly when it has an acute nature to it. However, it is very clear that even with a vaccine that's highly effective, that no vaccine is perfect. So there are two ways that you can use an antiviral. You can use it to treat someone who's already been infected, to prevent them to progress their disease to the point of requiring hospitalization. The thing that you heard about the other day was what I believe Pfizer was saying. They are developing a antiviral they would use for what's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means that if you are in a family setting where a member has the virus and inadvertently exposed you, rather than waiting to see if you are infected, was very similar, Alec, to the pre-exposure prophylaxis that we've developed for HIV, where you have people who are in a risk situation that they could take something that normally would be a therapy, but they're taking it as a pre-exposure prophylaxis. That's what Pfizer was talking about the other day.
Now, obviously, you are very famous and have been for previous pandemics. And in the 1980s, you were one of the people that led the charge against HIV here in the United States. And you made a statement or a comment that I thought was very, very compelling, where you said those people back then were fighting for their lives, not to defend a conspiracy theory like we often see now. How would you compare and contrast the response you've gotten? Is it the same? Because I know that you were attacked a lot. And then Larry Kramer came around and heroicized you when you were given the Congressional Medal of Freedom and so forth. It was very difficult for you in the beginning of the HIV crisis, correct?
It was, but it bettered me. It made me a better person. The criticism was to catch my attention. They were iconoclastic, theatrical, confrontative. But what they were saying is that this is a new paradigm. That we were going through the tried and true slow science, slow clinical trials, slow regulatory approval. And they were saying, we have a disease that by the time you realize what we have is that we don't have a lot more time to live. So you've got to get us involved in the clinical trial design. You've got to get the FDA to be more attentive. Since I was an openly involved federal employee, I became the face of the federal government. So they attacked me to gain my attention. Probably one of the best things I've ever done in my life, Alec, was to put myself in their shoes and say, well, wait a minute. These are people, young men, usually young gay men, who were suffering. They were pain. They were afraid for themselves.
Devastating
illness. And for their loved ones. So I said, let me put myself in their shoes. And when I did, it was a revelation. I said, I would be doing exactly what they're doing, without a doubt. So that's when I extended myself to them, and we forged a growing relationship that wasn't all rosy, even after I reached out. But over the years, they became extraordinary value added to our effort. So that's what I meant when I said it was something that was a productive confrontation that got our attention and said, please listen to what we have to say. And when we did, we got better at our jobs.
Now, as I recall, the bell in terms of the AIDS crisis was rung around 81, and that's 40 years ago. So to refresh the memories of those people listening who aren't necessarily completely familiar with the history of the AIDS crisis, what was the turning point in your mind that helped you to start to, if not find a cure for AIDS, and help to manage the disease?
Well, I got involved as a physician taking care of desperately ill patients because by the time they knew there was something wrong, they were desperately ill. So the first five patients that presented from Los Angeles with this strange pneumonia probably had been infected for years and did not even know it. So when I saw that first report, I thought it was a fluke and that it would go away. And then 1 month later, in July of 1981, the first report was in June, there was now not five gay men from LA, but there were 26 men, curiously, all gay. Like, where does that happen? Mm-hmm. All gay men, not only from LA, but from San Francisco and New York. And it was at that point, Alec, that I made a decision, which again, among the decisions that I've made that were good decisions, I decided I was going to put aside the things I was doing, which I was very successful at, and start studying these young gay men who were coming down with this devastating disease. And the first few years of that were really the dark years of my life and my professional career because everybody that we took care of died. Mm-hmm. And it was eerie and painful. But the thing that kept us through it is realizing the courage and the resilience of these young men who were being attacked by a disease that barely had a name. We used to call it GRID back then, gay-related immunodeficiency, and we certainly didn't know what it was. The big breakthrough came in 1983-84 when the virus was discovered. So now we knew who the enemy was. Before, it was like just pain of putting Band-Aids on hemorrhages and you didn't know what the cause of bleeding was.
Now, you were with NIAID then?
Yes, I was. I was a senior attending physician at the time, doing research on the immune system and its relationship to infectious diseases. So when this disease came along, I said, oh my goodness, if ever there was a disease for which I was trained as an immunologist and as an infectious disease person, this was it. So that came in 1983-84. The thing that was a dark, oh my God, like I got hit by a truck, was 1985, when what happened was we did the diagnostic test and we found that the people that we were taking care of who were sick were just the tip of the iceberg. Because when we started to test people in Los Angeles, in the Castro District of San Francisco, in Greenwich Village, we found out to our horror that like 30 to 40% of the gay men were infected. And that was inconceivable that they were already infected with a disease that I had spent the last 3 years watching people die from. So the next landmark would be, okay, so now you got the virus. So now you know who's infected. You got to get a therapy. And that's when all of the incredible work went into developing antivirals in an incremental way, first with AZT, which helped, got them a little better, but then they went down again. Mm-hmm. Then two drugs did pretty well. And then the breakthrough in 1996, when the triple combination, which was initiated with the protease inhibitors, but which since now we have much, much, much better drugs in the sense that we now went from my watching in an incredible, painful way. Every one of my patients, with few exceptions, die in 1981, 82, 83, 84, 85, to now that we hardly have any patients as inpatients. They're all outpatients. They're all leading essentially normal lives with maybe a couple of years of life expectancy clipped off. But now they're living vibrant, contributory lives. So that's the long journey of 40 years.
Right. Now, similar, I mean, no doubt different as far as you're concerned as a physician and a scientist, but to me similar in a way, which is, did we ever find out the cause of AIDS? Just as the question becomes, do we need to continue to find the cause of COVID? Because it seems to have dropped off the national conversation here as to what causes, in order for us to learn how we can prevent it from happening again, I presume.
Yeah, sure. That's a really great question. Well, let me just fine-tune one thing that you said, Alec. We know the cause. We don't know the origin of the cause.
Right, right.
Okay, so the cause is HIV. It's a virus. We know now by doing a phylogenetic tree that there's no doubt that decades ago, this virus jumped very likely from a chimpanzee into a human, a blip of an infection, person died, went away, jumped again into a human, blip of infection. Then all of a sudden, the right circumstances, the dissolution of colonization, the impact of commercial sex work, the truck-up trade that goes back and forth, the disruption of family unit. Then you had an outbreak that spread through the rest of the world because it was sexually transmitted. Mm-hmm. So we know for sure what went on there. We know for sure what the cause of COVID-19 is. It's SARS-CoV-2. It very likely, given the history of coronaviruses, SARS-CoV-1, MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, Ebola, Zika, that these things jump from animals to human. What we haven't yet nailed down is the precise lineage of from a bat to an intermediary to the human or directly from a bat to a human. We know that in the environment in China, there are bats that have viruses that are not absolutely very close, but close enough to make you want to do surveillance and find out what's going on in that animal-human interface that may have allowed it to jump species.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci. If you like conversations with people at the forefront of public health, go to our archives and listen to my talk with Dr. Joanne Liu, who at the time was president of Doctors Without Borders.
The threat of being abducted was so huge back then. And we knew that if something were ever to happen to the staff, the MSF staff, then we will pull out. So we were praying for not having anything bad happening to us because we knew that we're delivering really needed aid. On the other hand, it was so nerve-wracking.
You can hear the rest of that conversation at heresthething.org. When we return, more of my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Now, more of my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci. Should we check our antibodies before getting a booster?
You mean a third shot if you've been vaccinated first two?
Right.
No. And that's a firm answer to tell your wife. That boosters are given for the durability of protection as manifested by clinical observation, both in the United States cohorts, that the waning of protection goes down. I mean, the immune parameters go down too, but it doesn't really matter. When you look, it's clinically what counts, Alec. So it goes down for protection against infection and mild to moderate disease. It goes down less so, but it still goes down against protection against hospitalization and deaths. We believe that, at least I do as a physician and a scientist, that sooner or later, at the end of the day, we're going to realize that that third shot is going to be part of what the normal, complete, optimal vaccine regimen is. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, and I'll say this, it sounds crude, but it isn't, is that I don't really care what the level of antibody is in your wife. I think when her turn comes to get the boost, she should get the boost.
Got it. Got it. Can you mix vaccines? Our friend had J&J and was recommended to get a dose of Moderna. Can you mix vaccines safely?
It is optimal to be given the same product that you got originally, but the answer to your question is literally in real time being answered. We're doing a grid of mix and match, it's called, whereas you take people that have either gotten Moderna, Pfizer or J&J, you give them the third dose for an mRNA and a second dose for J&J, and you start, you give Moderna as the third dose, you give J&J as the dose, you give Pfizer as the dose, and you examine, is it safe? And does it induce an immune response that you would predict would be protective? We're already finished with the Moderna study. The J&J study is going to be done by the end of September, the beginning of October. And the Pfizer one will be done by the first to second week. When I say done, Alec, I mean the data will be collected enough to give to the company, which then will give it to the FDA for approval. Mm. So we're almost there.
Does this also include vaccines outside the U.S. like AstraZeneca?
We are not doing the mix and match yet for AstraZeneca. The Brits have done that.
Right.
So the data from the Brits have done that, and it looks like there's not a problem there at all.
Right. Now, I know you've been asked this question every 10 minutes, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it's my wife. I'm sure you understand.
Yes, sir.
When can we really expect kids to get vaccinated, and will it be two shots?
Okay. Your wife is something in common with millions of wives and mothers.
Yes.
So the answer is, as you know, Alec, that adolescents from 12 up to 17 now are already with Pfizer approved to get vaccinated.
Got it.
The question your wife is asking is 11 down to 5 and then ultimately 5 to, let's say, 6 months. So Pfizer has done the study already in children from 5 to 11. They announced yesterday that they have completed the study. They will be submitting the data to the FDA imminently, he said, within days. The FDA, you never want to get ahead of them. You don't want to predict what they're going to be able to do. But if, in fact, they find that those vaccines are safe and predictive of inducing an immune response that would be protective, then it is likely, if they approve it, because I always want to be careful, I don't get ahead of the FDA. If they approve it, it very likely will be before the end of October.
Interesting. When a mother is pregnant and she's vaccinated, do the babies have antibodies?
Yes. What happens is two things. The antibodies go across the placenta to the baby, number one. So when the baby is born, the baby already has the mother's antibody in his or her sera. Point number one. If the mother breastfeeds, that's another source of antibody for the baby.
Now, I'm going to pivot here to things that are more broader and more historical. I'm sure having been through what you went through with the AIDS crisis, which was a section of society, a relatively small section of society, I mean, that doesn't minimize the suffering, but now we have something in which the entire country, as people have said, it's changed the way we live forever. This thing has occurred, and you are a man who is the face of the United States government. Now, the weight of the world is not all that on your shoulders. You've got colleagues around the world that are working very hard in other countries to fight this, but certainly the weight of this country and how we live and how we don't live, masks, vaccines, distancing, quarantining, lockdowns, all of this madness. How was this different for you where the entire country was looking to you? I've got a variety of questions about this. The pressure on you. Did you ever feel like, my God, I don't know if I can see this through? Did you ever have any self-doubts?
Well, Alec, I have to tell you, I never have, and it isn't a question of self-doubt, is that this is what I do.
Right.
This is the life I chose. I did.
Another Godfather reference, by the way.
Yeah, right.
This is the business we've chosen.
Yeah, but, you know, when you go into global health and public health, you have to expect anything. You know, HIV, you're absolutely correct, and I like the way you framed it because it actually is triggering in my own mind. You know, another way I'll have to take the time to reflect on that. You're absolutely right. It was a segment, generally a segment of our population, even though it's a global pandemic, HIV is, which is sort of an interesting distortion that we've had. What's going on in sub-Saharan Africa is a much different thing that's going on in the United States. But you're right. You have to be prepared. When you're dealing with a public health crisis, it's got to be driven by public health principles. And one of the things that is different now, and I've said this publicly many times, if there's ever a time when you don't want societal divisiveness is when you're in the middle of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has made life extremely unusual for me is the fact that I am trying, and I've made the decision, that's my life. If I wanted to do something else, I would have made the choice. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect that it would be as public as it is, which, you know, is not something that I seek or care that much about. It's the public health. It's the fact that when you go into public health, when you're a physician and you're a scientist, you have a responsibility as a physician to the individual patient, and you have a responsibility to society as a public health official, which are all, society becomes your patient. Mm-hmm. And you want to do everything that's best for the patient. And one of the things that has been very difficult, I must say, but nonetheless, you just got to suck it up and do it, is that at the same time that you're trying to promote public health principles, you've become not only disliked, but hated by people. I mean, that is something you just don't ever imagine.
Right.
When you're training in a profession to help people, to save mm-hmm. their lives as individuals, which I've done in the many, many, many thousands of patients that I've taken care of. And as a public health official, when I got involved in public health issues, I never would have been imagined that the politicization of a public health issue would have caused not only pushback, but absolute scorn.
You've gotten death threats.
I have, yeah.
You've gotten some the extreme far edge of that. But at the same time, beyond that, beyond the insanity of that kind of thing, what's a criticism of the work you've done that's been the most painful for you? What's one that you think they really misunderstand what you're trying to do?
You know, and it's what they call saying, since they don't understand, I believe, the scientific aspect, he flip-flops. He changes his mind on things. Mm-hmm. Well, when you're dealing with an evolving outbreak in which every week and every month you get data that you did not have last month or last week, it would be unconscionable for you not to change the way you think about things based on the current data. And the thing they keep bringing up is the issue early on with the use of masks. Ah, he said you didn't really need to have masks back then, and now he's out there saying everybody should be wearing a mask. Well, the reason for the evolution in thinking is solid. It had to do with availability. It had to do with proof that they actually work. Mm-hmm. It had to do with a realization, which was stunning, Alec, that more than 50% of the infections were transmitted by someone who was without symptoms. There's no other disease that can actually kill you by a respiratory route, that is, mm-hmm. that people, half of them don't have any symptoms. When we realized that, it became clear that we really needed to do masks. But yet people who want to be ultrally critical will say, and well, you know, I could understand why, oh, he flip-flops. He flip-flops on this, he flip-flops on that. You know, does it bother me? It does, because you don't like people to think that you're a flip-flopper, but you'd like to say, let me sit down with you and explain that if you don't change your mind with the evolution of the new information, then you are really guilty of something that's not good.
The only thing worse than being perceived as a flip-flopper is not flip-flopping.
Exactly.
Or as you say, letting things evolve is the better phrase. Now, let me ask you this question. What grade do you give the American people for the way that they've responded to this pandemic?
Alec, I don't want to give it a grade. And the reason I don't, I do respect the fact that you're asking a very reasonable question. But people will watch this, and the next thing we knew, it's the soundbite of the year spread across by people who don't mean me well.
But are you concerned about the way? Because what I was going to say is, what I wanted to say as a prelude is, I view the COVID pandemic as the dress rehearsal for the climate change reality that's coming.
Yeah.
Where people are going to be asked to make significant changes, to go without, to make sacrifices about water usage, energy usage, so forth. I believe that the COVID was the dress rehearsal for the climate change that's looming. But what are your thoughts about how we've done?
There are many, many people in the country who have done it correctly and appropriately and have considered not only their health, the health of their family, but the health of society. One of the things that I find difficult is that I can't get the point across to people that as part of society, with all the benefits of being in society, you have a responsibility to society. And to say, I don't want to get vaccinated because I'll take my own chances. If I get infected, let me worry about it. So what? Well, that's not the way it works, my friend. What it works is that you could get infected and even get no symptoms or minimally symptomatic and inadvertently, and I'll even use the word innocently, pass it on to someone else.
A lethal dose.
A lethal dose. And that's the way you've got to think about it. And, you know, you talk about nobody's going to tell me to wear a mask and nobody's going to tell me to do this and nobody's going to tell me to do that. I get that. I understand the reluctance to that. But when you match it against the fact that already 680,000 Americans have died and close to 5 million people worldwide have died, sometimes societal interest should take precedence over your own feeling about what your individual liberties are.
Do you think that the, what I would call, I'm not going to ask you to call it this, but do you think that the anemic condition of science education in this country is a part of this suspicion that people have?
I think you're onto something really, really correct there, Alec. I think we really need to do much more so that everybody gets at least a modicum of science education to understand. You don't have to understand the intricacies of science with great formulas. You need to understand the importance and the relevance of science in society.
Well, one of the things that I think would make it difficult, and I say this with great respect, you are dazzlingly and effortlessly, you handle the political side of these questions quite well, which you need to do. I mean, you've got a job to do, and part of it is to avoid unnecessary controversy. But I'm wondering what it's like for you to be, you know, they go to the bullpen and they bring in Anthony Fauci again. Anthony Fauci is called in to help us to take on the pandemic. And you're a scientist and you're standing alongside a president who's telling people to drink bleach in order to address the COVID. What can you say, not about the former president himself, but what could you say about the challenges of the early days of the COVID back in March of last year? Were there things you knew we had to do? Did you have strong feelings about things you wanted to do and you realized that it was an uphill battle to convince the people who were in charge?
Yeah. So I will answer your question directly, Alec. But one thing I do want to make clear to the listeners of this podcast that you said, you know, they bring me in from the bullpen. You know, I may have been brought in, but we have a really, really good team. And I want to make it clear that I am part of a very strong team. I'm probably maybe more recognizable than other members of the team, but they're really a solid team that we have. Yeah, please note that, because I really do mean that sincerely, not just superficially. But directly answering your question is that you always have to let the science be your guide. I've told the story multiple times, and I'll very briefly relate it now because it really is what has guided me through advising seven presidents, is that the first time I walked in to answer some questions of Ronald Reagan about the AIDS outbreak, you know, even before we knew a lot about it, someone who is a wise friend of mine who worked in former White Houses told me, I have a little bit of advice for you. I would have hoped that I would have come to that conclusion even without his advice. But his advice was, when you walk into the White House, whether to brief the president or other people in power, just tell yourself when you walk through that awning to the West Wing that this may be the last time I'm walking into this place because I might have to tell the president or someone else something that's a truth, but an inconvenient truth that they may not want to hear, and the messenger may never got asked back again. And that's what I've done. I've just told the truth. So when things were being said during the last administration that I found were contrary to the facts and the evidence, I did not take any pleasure in contradicting a president of the United States because I have a great deal of respect for the presidency of the United States. But I had to disagree. And sometimes I was put into the very awkward position of having to do it publicly. I think you've seen that on TV during those press conferences where the president would say something about hydroxychloroquine or about something else. And then the reporter would ask me, and I'd have to say, now's the moment. You're either going to have to tell the truth, maintain your own integrity, and possibly not get asked back, or do the other thing, which would be unconscionable for me. So I went with my integrity, and I told the truth. Now, that triggered an incredible amount of backlash, not necessarily from the president, to be quite honest with you, but from some of the people around him who began doing opposition research on me and writing editorials that I didn't know what I was talking about. That was uncomfortable. I did not take any pleasure in having to speak about something that was contrary to what the president was saying. You know, the people who throw darts at me say, oh, I was just trying to bring down the president. Absolutely not.
Of course not.
Yeah. I was trying to just tell the truth.
When I would watch you on TV back in those days, it's what we call the highest form of acting, which is that your face gives away nothing, but somehow almost telepathically we understand what's going on inside your mind, just in your eyes. The president would be holding forth about hydroxychloroquine, and the camera would cut to you, and to see you managing your thoughts and your feelings. Like we say, some of the greatest acting I've ever seen was you maintaining your self-control during these conferences. Now, let's say the president wants to order that you can't get on a U.S. airplane domestically without showing a vaccination card. How does that happen? Meaning, does the president make that call? The CDC? The FDA? Who's in charge there?
Well, again, just so that the audience is clear, that this is something that is discussed but is not actually implemented at all or even decided on. In fact, what the president has said, as you well know, that if people refuse to wear masks on planes, they will double the fine just to make it more difficult for that. The process will be that nothing like that would happen unless, obviously, the president gives it the okay. But the mechanism whereby it's implemented would very likely be some sort of a recommendation from the CDC that would then be implemented by the airlines, and they would be the ones that would very likely monitor that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have some friends of mine who are hardcore anti-vaxxers. Bobby Kennedy Jr. has been a friend of mine for decades. And he comes out, and not necessarily him, but other people, they cast you in a very harsh light. They say that you are the public health equivalent of a war profiteer, that you are lining your pockets as a result of these pandemics.
Yeah, well, Alec, that is clearly all conspiracy theory. My finances are public knowledge. So my financial statement that's required by my position will be very, very clear that I make zero when it, not a little zero. And that's very clear. And anybody that knows anything about government regulations would know that. So, I mean, the things that have been said about me and about my wife, I mean, that she's making millions too, right? And she's another government employee who's devoted her entire life to the health of patients, but that's the world we live in. So that's just nonsense. That's all fantasy.
What's one thing that anti-vaxxers, if anything, are saying that you kind of understand their fear and their trepidation?
I have always, the same way that when the activists with HIV were being confrontative and theatrical and iconoclastic, I always try to see, is there something about what they're saying that I need to pay attention to? And I think one can understand that if people don't understand what a vaccine is and what it will do and what its purpose is, and they just feel somebody's injecting something into my body and it's my body and I don't want to do it. I try, when I talk to people that way, to go step by step with them as to what it is that they object to and why do they object to it. Never, ever, ever being judgmental. Because once you start to be judgmental, then you've turned them off against you completely and it's a lost cause. But try to outreach. The other thing, Alec, is that the messenger is as important as the message, in that you want to get someone, and we call it trusted communicators and trusted people in society. So if you get someone who really is very, very much attuned to the church, whatever that church is, and religion, and you get someone who's a pastor, a minister that they trust, to get them to sit and talk about it. Some people trust sports heroes or entertainment figures or very famous actors like yourself, that they would say, well, you know, I kind of admire that person. If they say it, I'll think about it. Whereas if somebody like me, who is an obvious public figure that works for the federal government, they may instinctively not want to hear what I have to say. So even though a lot of people do listen to what I have to say, there are many people who feel differently. So you've got to match the messenger with the receiver of the message.
More of my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci when we return. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Once again, my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, during your career, your long career, and even looking back historically prior to when you were working in this field of public health, who's someone who's a hero of yours? Who's someone who you know who dedicated their life to the work you're doing now, who you thought did great work?
His name is Maurice Hilleman, and many people don't know who he is. Maurice Hilleman was a man responsible for the development of about 12 or more of the vaccines that are given to children that have saved hundreds of millions of lives. And he was a guy from Montana who was a tough son of a gun, who took no prisoners, did what he felt was important, worked hard, let the science drive what he did, and didn't care at all about credit or prizes or things. He just did his thing. So he's really one of my heroes.
For preventing future pandemics, some people recommend the creation of a new federal agency to mount a fast response at the first outbreak. For COVID-19, this type of agency would have been stockpiling and then distributing PPE, for example, to be funded continuously, not just in the time of crisis. What's your feelings about that?
Well, I'm not sure I would say an agency that would be solely interested in the next pandemic. What the problem you're going to run into, Alec, is that the space between pandemics would mean, what is it that they're going to do? You still need a CDC for surveillance of things that are not pandemic, for all the public health things. You still need an NIH to do the basic and clinical research that, quite frankly, led to the successful vaccines in record time. Some people don't appreciate it was the decades of research done by scientists that people never heard of.
Yeah. It was the Manhattan Project. Yeah.
Right. You've got to be careful of creating a new agency. What we do need is we need the current agencies to be able to go into motion ahead of time. The NIH do the research for better prototype pathogen vaccines. The CDC to get better surveillance, communication, and local health. The companies to be able to get the capability of getting a vaccine in absolute record time. Now, if you want a coordinating group above that to make sure that you get pandemic preparedness, that's fine. But to create yet again another agency,
right,
might not be a great idea.
Right. Now, looking out over the arc of the next year, because like everybody else, I was sitting at a table in Brooklyn rehearsing a television program we were about to shoot for 5 months, all of March, April, May, June, blah, blah, blah. We were all getting ready to go. We shut down. We go home. We go back in October, and we had some pretty intense COVID protocols. The crew had to wear smart watches, and there was a director at a table, and they had a system whereby once they cut the camera, because everybody congregates to shoot the scene, and once we cut the camera and we're going to move on to the next shot, the next angle, the system was engaged, and everybody who was wearing the smart watches in the crew, if you were within 6 feet of the person for more than 10 seconds, the watch went off.
Wow.
They didn't want anybody around. And we only had four cases. We had five cases and only one in the shooting crew. The other four were extras who came from outside of our bubble, so to speak. We had one COVID case on a crew of 200 people, production office, drivers, unit, cast, everything, shooting crew, everything. It was really everybody. What you see, as you know, is people working so hard. At my children's school, the people are working. They're saying, please don't blow it. You know what I mean? We got the kids in school. All the staff is vaccinated. All the faculty is vaccinated. We're moving along. It's like the little engine that could. You know, we're trying to get the kids back in school, which is what we need. Besides improving vaccination rates and going to whatever lengths we have to pressure people to get vaccinated, what do you predict we're going to see over the arc of the next 12 months? What would you like to see?
Well, what I would like to see is something that I know is scientifically true, is that if we combine the successful implementation of vaccine, getting those 70 million people who are eligible already to be vaccinated, not counting your children who are not yet eligible, but those who are already eligible, to get the vast majority of them vaccinated at the same time that we make a major effort about our responsibility for the rest of the world to get them vaccinated, so that we as a leading rich country, together with the European Union and Australia and Canada and all the others, to get the world vaccinated, because a global pandemic requires a global response. Having said all of that, my arc of the next year is that at least in this country, if we do that together with the kind of mitigation methods that you and your crew used, I believe that by the time we get through this winter and into the spring, and we get through it okay, and we get the people vaccinated, we could start proceeding towards some sort of normality. Now, it is very difficult to predict, because getting back to a question you asked me before, if we don't get there, they'll say, there he goes, he flip-flopped again. So I have to start off by saying, A, I don't know, but B, we have it within our power to do this. You know, being with diseases, if I might just take an extra 30 seconds, Alec,
please,
because it really is important. Having dealt with diseases in which you don't have an effective remedy, you don't have a vaccine, or you don't have a therapy, to be with a disease in which you have the answer, but you're not implementing the answer, is a very tough thing to swallow. It really is.
Now, what's something that Dr. Anthony Fauci loves to do that he's not getting to do anymore because of the COVID? How's it affected your day-to-day life?
Well, my day-to-day life is very unusual, Alec, because it is totally consumed. You know, I could say something that is not whining about it. It's true. I haven't taken a day off in 20 months. And that's probably not healthy and kind of silly. My wife keeps pushing me and my friends keep pushing me. But every time you think you're going to take a day off, there's something else that has to be done.
People are counting on you.
Yeah. So you don't do it. What I would love to do is, I did it recently, is to have my three daughters, who I adore, easily able to come and visit me and to not be afraid that they're going to get a breakthrough infection, they're vaccinated, and give it to their 80-year-old father. Because as a matter of fact, you said something that resonated with me. You were joking about yourself that I'm 80 years old and I'm a late in life dad too. And I have three girls, one as young as in her 20s. So you could imagine I'm sort of in the same class as you.
I actually do have something in common with you. Wow. I'm flattered.
Yeah.
Now, my last question is flu season. Are you concerned about flu season?
You know, I am. And the reason I am is that I don't want people to get such fatigue with COVID that they do not get their flu vaccine. What you don't want is the conflation of two outbreaks that are respiratory borne. It will be confusing, it will be frustrating, and it will give the hospitals a big, big strain.
So if you've had the COVID injection, if you've had both shots, go get the flu shot as well?
Absolutely, Alec. Got it. Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, let me just say, you know, you are someone who I can't imagine how you've lived your life these last 20 months. You have had the weight of the world on your shoulders. You and your colleagues and everyone else you work with at your institution and FDA and CDC, any government agency around the world that's working assiduously to try to address this problem, these are people who have taken the weight of the world on their shoulders because we've never seen anything like this. And I pray to God we've never seen anything like this again. But I wanted to thank you for taking your valuable time to come on with us.
Thank you very much, Alec. It has been a pleasure and an honor. I mean that. Thank you for having me. Take care.
My thanks to Dr. Anthony Fauci. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Kerry Donahue, and Zach McNeese. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing is brought to you by iHeartRadio.